Welcome back to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. The final part of Carissa Fralin's presentation at Manchester University is a Q&A with the audience. Thank you for listening and for supporting WBOI Presents on 89.1 WBOI.
Our group was wondering, how does this look specifically in rural communities versus metropolitan or inner city? Especially coming from a rural environment myself, how a lot of times mental health issues turn into, well, that's just the crazy guy down the street, and so then people can sort of isolate themselves and then not reach out. So how do you find those people and how do you bring them the care that they need?
Mm-hmm. Great question. So I think largely what we have found in Colorado, which is what I can speak to, is that in rural areas in particular, stigma seems much stronger when talking about mental health issues and when talking about substance use disorders. And so I think in those communities, there are several ways that they sort of approach that. One is, remember back, we were talking about what we know. We know that 80% of people with behavioral health issue go to see their primary care doc at least one time a year to get some sort of checkup or to get something fixed. And so that's a great time to do screening. In Colorado, we've implemented what we call SBIRT, which is S-B-I-R-T. S is screening, B-I is brief intervention, and then if the person needs more than that, referral and treatment. And so it starts with a screening tool, and these are evidence-based tools that are used across the country. And they screen for depression, they screen for anxiety, because those are really the ones that we see the most in primary care. Certainly people with more severe mental health issues come into primary care settings, bipolar, schizophrenia, we see those in primary care for sure. But for the most part, they go to the community mental health center and connect with people there and see physicians now that are embedded in those community mental health centers. In primary care, we see a lot of the depression and anxiety pieces. And so the best way to do that, to catch that, is to screen right when people get there and just make it a part of what happens every single time. So when a person comes in, it's not like, oh, they look depressed, let's give them a screen. It's every person who comes in the door gets screened. And so, of course, people can answer dishonestly and things like that. But a lot of people answer, I mean, when they're filling out a piece of paper, they're pushing a button on an iPad, most people will just answer normally and they'll answer truthfully because, you know, they're at their doctor's office and they're there for a reason, to see their doctor, to get help from him or her. So that screening process is important. And then with integration, if you've got that behavioral health, you know, intervention going on, that provider right there in the clinic or close by, then that brief intervention can happen immediately. So that's a lot how we do it in Colorado. One of my favorite stories, too, is one of our community mental health centers in a rural area is incorporated physical health into their center. But the man who lives there is fourth generation in that community. So he's very well known, has a lot of connections, which works for him because what he does is every morning his routine is to go down to the cafe and have breakfast with the farmers so that he can get kind of take the temperature of the community of what's happening and what's going on and who hasn't been around lately and we haven't seen this guy and we don't know what's happening. And he does outreach in that way. So he's connected with his community, but then if he hears something that feels a little off, then he can go and see the person and check in with them. Now, that's it's a wonderful story, but it's not necessarily a common experience because he's got this whole family connection in that community. But that's one way that things happen. There are people in this community who have lived here for generations, and so they have those kinds of connections as well. Yes?
What would you recommend that us students do, like when we go into the healthcare profession, what we can do to foster change and create access for these communities?
Yeah, great question. So two suggestions for that. So one I would say is keep talking about it. So when you're in your classrooms, when you're talking with your professors, and you're learning the medical side of whatever profession it is that you're going into, talk about behavioral health, talk about the social determinants of health, talk about looking at whole person care, and keep your professors on track about what it is that needs to happen when you're providing care to people directly. I would also say, if you're going to do family practice, if you're a doc and going to do family practice, find a residency program that's integrated already. There are many in the country now that have integrated care teams of care managers, behavioral health providers. Get used to working in that environment when you're there. Do an internship in a clinic that is integrated. Look around for those opportunities, get a feel for what it's like, and then you'll know more how to advocate for that when you are in a place that doesn't have it. One of the programs that I worked in and that is a part of the SIM cohort is a residency program. We actually have two residency programs in family medicine. And family docs graduate from those residencies and they get to, you know, clinics and they're like, hey, where's my behavioral health provider? So then the clinics have to rethink how they do medicine and how they treat their patients. So that's one way that you can do that. And if you're a pharmacy student, don't think that you, or thinking about being a pharmacy student, don't think that you're not in that mix. The first integrated care clinic I worked in had case managers, behavioral health providers, a pharmacist, and a dietitian. So integrated care can look a lot of different ways, but a pharmacist being a part of that picture is really important because a lot of things can and should be managed by medication, mental health issues included. Medication is not the enemy. Medication is helpful, but you need other pieces as well. Great question. Thank you.
This is Ben Clemmer. The next question was asked by an audience member who did not use a microphone. She asked Carissa Fralin about the distinctions made between substance abuse and mental illness. Thank you for listening to WBOI.
Because sometimes substance use disorder is not necessarily connected to mental illness. They are not necessarily direct results of each other, though certainly they can be. But also because in the medical world in particular, that's how payment has been structured. So we've had payment structured by physical health and mental health and substance use or abuse. And so payments are different. Fee-for-service world, it all looks different. It all comes from separate pots. You bill different ways, you have to have different credentialing, all of those things. And so oftentimes that's why they're talked about separately. Also, I think to call it out a little bit more clearly, because substance use disorder, when it gets lumped in with mental health, sometimes gets overlooked as its own thing. And so I think that is another reason that it gets called out. And right now it's sort of a hot topic because of opioid misuse. And so now, anytime you hear about substance use disorder or SUD, you also hear about OUD, which is opioid use disorder. So those things kind of are going hand in hand. And that is something that's interesting because that really impacts the medical world and primary care. Because if you are a doc that prescribes opioids sometimes, now you have to be really careful about how that looks, and you got to figure out how to help people manage their pain. Because pain is real, people have it, and so how do we work through that in a different way? How do we look at it in a different way?
The next audience member referenced turnover in behavioral health and treatment in Northeast Indiana and asked Fralin if she sees the same turnover in clinics in Colorado.
Oh, yes. So it happens more in Colorado with community mental health centers like Bowen Center and less in primary care setting. It's interesting because in Colorado, we now have a workforce shortage because all of these primary care clinics want to integrate behavioral health providers into their clinic, and we just don't have enough people to do it. So so most of the behavioral health providers have been trained as therapists or social workers or something that is not necessarily healthcare related. And so now we're having to relook at, first of all, we've got to find people. Secondly, we've got to retrain them or at least give them a set of core competencies to follow so that they can get into a primary care clinic and actually make some good impact. A lot of times what we found in our attempt to integrate is that a primary care clinic would hire an LCSW or an LPC to come and work, and they just want to sit in their office and do therapy all day. But that's not how a clinic works. Clinics are hustling and bustling, and people are in and out, and you got to go in and out of rooms, and you'll probably see 10 people through the day, and they're quick, you know, fast-paced and all of that. And some therapists are like, whoa, that's not what I signed up for. So it's about kind of retraining some of that. So we were very fortunate. We have three schools of social work in the state of Colorado that have masters and or PhDs. And all three of them were funded through the federal government, through Health Resource and Service Administration. And they are now getting funding specifically to help train social workers in healthcare settings. So some of that has to do with primary care integration, some of it then in hospitals and other types of clinics. And so it's kind of this full picture now of really starting to notice that we need some training that looks a little bit different. Good question.
A lot of what you described today sounds pretty, it's really hopeful. I mean, it sounds good, and it even sounds fairly, I guess, a lot like common sense. And so I'm wondering, because this is not the way that healthcare works in a lot of other parts of the country. Mm-hmm. So if you, and you don't have to speak to the rest of the country, but I'm wondering, so what are the points of resistance to what you're talking about and what you were explaining today? Like, why would anyone oppose what you're describing?
Yeah, well, money. That's probably the biggest, I would say, barrier to this kind of integration, is that right now there's just not a lot of ways to pay for it. And so it's hard for clinics to do it this way. If you're in a big system, big healthcare system, like the big hospital I had a picture of is part of a system called Centura in the state of Colorado, and they own like four or five hospitals, and they have clinics all over the place, and they're huge. Probably like Parkview here, right? They have lots and lots of system money. It's easier for them. Centura was like, yeah, we're just going to make it a priority because their clinics have been involved in SIM. So they're like, we're just going to make it a priority. And so if these clinics make money, you know, doing surgeries that need to be done, and we can shift it over here and pay for behavioral health providers, we're going to do that. But it's harder when it's a smaller, like mom and pop, or maybe it's a pediatric clinic that has two, you know, sites or something like that. Then it's much harder because you got to figure out how to pay for it. Got to figure out how to get money enough to cover it. Right now, in the fee-for-service world, it's not there. We don't have enough codes to cover it. We don't have enough of those kinds of fee-for-service things. So our conversation constantly is with the payers who are at the table in Colorado saying, hey, we need you guys to help us pay for this. We need you to help clinics pay for this so docs can have these folks. We know that it works. Here's the data. Let's see a little money. So that's part of the barrier. And we have to keep in mind, too, in Colorado, we have all of these payers at the table, but they're a part of a very big ship that is in multiple states. And so trying to get them to kind of get on board with that can be tricky sometimes, for sure. I would say, too, that Medicare is leading the way there. Medicare is changing how they're going to pay for services. And so states that get Medicaid are also going to have to now start changing that a little bit. And commercial payers are also starting to follow that. It's going to be a long process, but I do think that we're making strides forward to get that done.
Our last question comes from an audience member asking how the integration of behavioral health services has impacted Colorado by the numbers.
Yes, great question. So she's asking about data. So I'm not a data person, just to be clear, but we have collected a ton of it. And it looks great. It looks great. I mean, more people are gaining access, more people. They don't necessarily know that they're in an integrated setting, but they can absolutely say, hey, I went to see my doctor and I was feeling really low because my brother had just died recently, and I was able to talk to somebody right away and get the help I needed. Or, you know, I was able to go in and my son was really having difficulty and we had somebody right there we could talk to and it was great. Or, you know, I didn't know how to get food for my family and somebody was right there to help me do that. So they don't necessarily know the word, but they know they have access. And so that, I think, has been an incredible gain for our state, for sure. And it looks like, as we continue to kind of roll in that data, that more and more people are having access. And our goal is 80% of the state, that 80% of people will have the ability to access behavioral health through primary care if they choose to do so. Thank you so much, everyone. It was great to be here.
This has been an episode of WBOI Presents. Special thanks to Matt Unger and his team at Manchester University for providing the audio for this program. Next week, we will bring you another program from the Values, Ideas, and the Arts series at Manchester. With elections getting closer, we'll hear a panel from Manchester University professors discussing the Constitution. Our music is by Mark Waldick. Folktales is next. Have a wonderful night.